Hi everyone, I'm Gary Nall. We're broadcasting all over the world. We're trying to share a truth that is rarely found within the mainstream discourse. Imagine those heroic individuals on 9/11. I was there doing a run for the first time. I always ran north to the George Washington Bridge. On that morning, returning from Florida earlier, I ran south. There I saw it. And later I would think about all those people who lost their lives trying to save other people. Right now there is an effort on behalf of the American and world public by a relatively small group, small comparison to the opposition, about 100,000 more or less scientists, physicians, and journalists, and activists who are trying to rush into the crisis of COVID to rescue the citizens before they make wrong choices, trusting in the official version. I'd like to let you know we have a really powerful show today. You're going to hear from some individuals you have not heard of before, didn't know existed. For example, we're going to tell you brand new information about what we now know we didn't before the vaccines, but well, now that the vaccine is in your body, Dr. Robert Malone, the inventor of the RNA vaccine technology, no one more aware than this astute medical doctor and scientist, and also an expert in vaccines and an expert in, let's say, the whole field of virology. He's one of the world's leading virologists. And he is pro-vaccine, needless to say. He is pro-FDA. On all levels, he is pro-establishment. And in a discussion with Professor Brett Weinstein, an evolutionary biologist, at a three-hour discussion in the middle, at 2 hours and 17 minutes and 22 seconds, he makes a statement about what you're actually getting that is so dangerous, and it's shocked him. So here's the man who invented the RNA technology that's been used in the vaccines. You don't get any closer to the truth than him. You'll hear that truth today. So please let people know that in about 15 minutes you're going to hear from him. But then we're also going to have a discussion where Dale Bigtree is interviewing Dr. Michael Yeadon. Michael Yeadon, the former top scientist and virologist for Pfizer, with a background in immunology also. For 17 years of his 40-year career, all of it spent in mainstream research with major companies, he is set at the table as one of the inventors of drugs and helping with vaccines. But then he decided to tell the truth. He is one of those rare breeds of people who believe that you cannot lie to yourself. If you know something is wrong, say it. And he did. And his whole world changed. So he is now telling people what he believes is the truth. You can hear what he has to say. And it may give you a broader perspective from which to make your own individual choices. Interesting, because one of my longtime close friends sent me an email last night. And here's what it says. And this is from Steve Brown, one of the leading intellectual lights of the liberal establishment for, I guess, 60 years. Quote, "It seems that everything you told me months ago about COVID-19 that had been poo-hooed and censored by mainstream media and government agencies, including most of Pacifica and Democracy Now, is surfacing and becoming, quote, respectable topic of discussion. With mainstream media desperately trying to find a way to avoid looking like idiots or accomplices, Fauci and the relevant government agencies are attempting to redefine gain of function in order to get out of the way of what looks like a damning congressional investigation." I don't think Fauci will ever actually be disgraced, but will probably soon submit a voluntary request to retire in order to spend time with his family. Global research has especially focused on this issue, printed over 30 articles in the past few weeks, end quote. It was also my good friend who pooh-hooed all this. He took the two vaccines, which is his business, and I'm certainly going to support my friends in what they do. I don't tell them what to do or not to do. But he also was one of those people, when the AIDS epidemic was occurring, saw firsthand. He was at the Tri-State Healing Center. He saw the people who were near death when they came in and saw the revitalization of people over the years. And yet, this cognitive disconnect between what I see as a truth in this moment, but what my beliefs are, that I can't accept this moment. That was also true with COVID. So now, he is but one of many who were true believers who now are questioning. And he is correct. Global research has done a tremendous good by publishing articles. We have, on GaryNall.com, we have dozens of articles published, all accurate, and being disseminated. I give you that just because we're at a crucial moment where we have to look for the truth and not place any biases or ideology in front of it. Just let it be what it is. You're going to hear that today. But first, we're going to the latest on, of all things, something you've probably never had in your life, brown seaweed. I don't like seaweed. I don't like the way it tastes, but I love seaweed salads because that's after I've marinated it overnight, including a brown seaweed or hijiki or kombu or wakame, any of these. And I marinate it in a marinade sauce with a slight lemon juice, lime juice, extra virgin olive oil, and let it sit overnight. And then I brush it with mustard over it, dice it up, and put it into an arugula salad. That's a tasty salad. But the University of New South Wales in Australia wants you to know that when you're eating brown seaweed, it is helping you lose weight. It is helping you to no longer be obese. So just try to have, as they did in this study, a diet that includes a serving of seaweed for 16 weeks, brown seaweed. Not to be outdone, the Institute for Genomic Biology at the University of Illinois published an article on marine drugs showing the new health benefits of red seaweeds. Red seaweeds, by the way, have been prevalent in the diets of Asian communities for thousands of years. In a new study published in this peer-reviewed journal, they showed how these algae confer health benefits. Quote, in the past, people have wondered why the number of colon cancer patients in Japan is the lowest in the world. This is from a professor of food microbiology. Quote, many assumed that it was due to some aspect of the Japanese diet or lifestyle. We wanted to ask whether their seaweed diet was connected to the lower frequency of colon cancer, end quote. Okay, so what did they find out? Now, although several studies have shown that Asians who eat seaweed regularly have lower risk of colon, colorectal, and breast cancer, it was still not really crystal clear which components were responsible for the anti-cancer effects. In my world, it doesn't matter. Just eat red seaweeds. Cook them. Put them in brown rice. You can use what I like to do, when you make your brown rice, instead of making your brown rice in water, two parts water to one part brown rice, put some miso in there, because the miso with coconut oil coats all of the individual's little kernels, and as a result, you get a very fluffy rice. But the taste of the miso, and if you want a light miso, you use barley, chickpea. But then also at the end of that cooking process, when it's steeping for 10 minutes, when you've turned off the flame, dice up your red seaweed and put it in. And that really sparks it. You can also put some hibachi plum in as well. Add some extra. And even if you want to really zing it, put in some lemongrass. Now, that'll give you a brown rice that's really unusual and exotic, and it's not just aromatic. It doesn't have that kind of traditional Mediterranean taste. It has a very exotic, let's say, Pacific taste of the islands. In any case, what they're finding is that there are enzymes and in there, and there's very specific phytonutrients. And they found that it really helps, and it interferes in the cancer process. So to prevent cancers, take red seaweeds. From the University of Hertfordshire in the United Kingdom, hiking workouts aren't just good for your body, they're good for your mind too. What do I mean? Well, before COVID-19, the popularity of hiking was on a downslope in both adults and children. I know upstate New York, a lot of people used to love to hike and, you know, find a lake and go swimming. I've done that. In fact, I had a lake upstate, a four-acre lake, a small lake on the Fertiller Farm, and thousands of you swam in that lake, ice cold all year, even in August, when it'd be 95 degrees out. You go in and it would be cold. It was all spring-fed, and a cold spring, delicious. That was the water that I pumped into the house and had. But today, I would think twice if I were the average person. Now, if you knew what to do, if you knew to use coconut oil and tea tree oil on your shoes and so that repels ticks, but otherwise it's so easy to sit down and 5 minutes later you got ticks all over you. Now you get Lyme's disease or potential for Lyme's disease. Not all ticks carry it. But now it's regaining some popularity. And it spiked during the pandemic. Many people were taking to the trails as than usual. Hiking is not only just a great way to get outside and to see nature, and we have such a beautiful country to explore. It's also good for physical and mental health. Hiking is different in many ways from taking a regular stroll around your neighborhood. Not only is the terrain on many hiking trails uneven and rocky, there's also typically some change in elevation, such as going up and down hills. People also tend to wear different footwear, such as hiking boots, which can be heavier than what they are used for, let's say, jogging. These differences in terrain and footwear mean hiking has a higher energy expenditure, meaning you're burning more calories than walking on flat ground does. This is due to the fact that we need to use more muscles to stabilize ourselves when we're walking on uneven terrain. So while brisk walking at a speed of around, I would say around 14 miles per hour, you can get, 14 minutes in a mile. That would be a good training session. You would be aerobic, your heart would be beating, your muscles being used, and you're going to burn a lot of energy if you're doing that hiking. So hike fast and see how that works. It's good for you, getting outdoors too. And finally, from University of Medical Sciences, an article published in Phytotherapy Research shows that a trial finds improvement in metabolic syndrome components in fatty liver and insulin resistance when you're using garlic. Yeah. The more garlic you eat, the healthier you're going to be. Lower your blood pressure, killing bacteria in the throat and intestine. It's good all over. But in this case, it's helping you reduce the risk of diabetes and cardiovascular disease. That's important. And it also reduces the insulin resistance and reduces fatty liver conditions. All that. It lowers blood pressure, lowers triglycerides, and lowers blood sugar. And it lowers the low-density lipoprotein and increases the good high-density lipoprotein. All that from just over a gram and a half of garlic a day. That's not much. So, you want to fight pneumonia? Curcumin. A preclinical review of all the scientific literature showed curcumin is a natural phytochemical with anti-inflammatory and anti-neoplastic characteristics, meaning it fights cancer, but it also turns off inflammation in the lungs. So that's important. Simple things. I'm Gary Nall. We're 16 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break. When we come back from our break, I'm going to go to a clip. And the first clip I'm going to go to is, it's three people sitting at a table talking. Not a good interview, in my opinion, because they were talking over each other. But when you hear what they have to say, and you can see them, you can watch this in real time, listen carefully to what Dr. Robert Malone, the inventor of the RNA vaccine, has to say that they're now finding that's really scary. And not a word about this in any of the mainstream media.
Sure. So, and are we brought, we're...
Oh, wait. No, they can't see a damn thing. All right, what am I doing?
Yeah.
I'm going to put on my glasses.
Okay. He has to look at his cheat sheet.
Yes, I do. My son created this so that I would look like an expert. Oh, there we go.
There you go. Okay. So, Byram Brittle did a freedom of action request of the Japanese government for the Pfizer data, and he got a biodistribution chart. And I'm pretty sure I linked to the original data in my paper. And this graph was created from that Pfizer data. So this is not the Pfizer data itself from the Pfizer study. This is a graph, and people have double checked and triple checked this.
Yeah, it's a summary graphic.
It's a summary graph so that you can
see it visually.
Seen,
I did review the primary data, and I concur that the primary data is consistent with the graph that you have nicely summarized.
Right. And so what you see from this graph is that when you inject in the shoulder, it these.
Do you want to walk through the teach the listener how it shows that?
How it shows.
What you yeah, mean? What you're just saying.
So, yeah, there, some of these people, some people will just listen to this. So what we're looking at is a graph of different lines of concentration of, is this spike protein in various tissues?
No. Yes, it's a lipid nanoparticle.
Oh, it's the lipid nanoparticle, which is
the delivery
mechanism.
Right, it's like the Fed.
It is the drug.
Well, for it's the box. It's the box in which the mRNA.
It's a proxy for the drug. So the mRNA is what causes the manufacture of the spike protein. But if you find the lipid nanoparticles, that tells you that your drug got to this location.
Right. It's the delivery box, effectively. It's the FedEx delivery box that has the mRNA inside.
This is, you're exactly right. This is the lipid component.
Yeah.
Right. That does the delivery.
Okay, so good. So what we've got here are different lines that tell you over time from a quarter of an hour to 48 hours where you find what the concentration in various tissues are. And you've got some strong signals here. You've got it in whole blood, not surprisingly, over the first 4 hours. In other words, it's moving around, it's circulating.
That in and of itself is unusual.
And concerning.
Right. It should be in the interstitial fluid.
So forgive me, just to get a little more precise, we've administered by needle into the deltoid of this complex.
Yeah.
And you're just tracking the lipid part of it now. There's also an RNA part of it. But as you say, it quickly moves into the blood. Plasma is the cell-free fraction. That's the yellow mustard line. And the gray line is whole blood. So that includes the cellular part of blood.
Yeah.
Okay. Carry on.
Okay. And then we get lines that rise. So all of these things decline as basically this diffuses through the body, which actually is not what you would hope. You would hope it would stay in the arm, but it's basically diffusing through the body. So concentrations are dropping as it gets more and more evenly distributed. And then concentrations are rising conspicuously in two places as we close in on 48 hours. One of them is in the ovaries where it goes sky high. That's really frightening.
Anybody that's looked at this data says, what?
Yeah, that is a very frightening signal.
And it's the cognitive dissonance between what the CDC says is that this is safe for pregnant women.
Right.
This is perfectly safe. And it's on the CDC website. It's unbelievable.
It's at some level, it's not safe for women at all. I mean, this is
right.
Before we interpret the data, let's make sure your listeners understand it.
Okay. So the ovaries show a high concentration. For whatever reason, it's ending up in the ovaries preferentially. Yes, the lipid is ending up there. And then the other place that we have a signal, which I think suggests something we need to worry farther down the road. You tell me, Robert, if I'm on the right track here or not. But the fact that it shows up concentrating in bone marrow.
Bad news.
Actually, that suggests that you could end up with, I'm not saying this is going to happen, but I'm saying we need to look for something like leukemias showing up here because of their creation in bone marrow. I know from other work that it also seems to show up preferentially in lymph nodes, which raises the question of whether or not lymphomas might be created. In any case, these are possible long-term effects that we have no way of knowing don't arise because these things have not been injected into people for more than a year.
So we have two adverse event signals that are starting to become apparent, my friends at the FDA tell me.
Okay.
That are relevant to what you're saying. You're focusing on bone marrow. Mm-hmm. So typically aplastic anemia, leukemia, lymphoma, those kinds of things might, if there are, is going to be a signal, we might see it 6 months, 3 years, 9 years. Okay. Hard to tell. Cause this is a progression of cancer that mm-hmm. often requires multiple mutations.
Yep.
Okay. So let's just park that.
Yeah.
It is a risk that should be monitored.
Well, wait a second. Well, you said somebody is beginning to see a signal of something, but I didn't get what it was.
Yeah. So I was going to get into that.
Okay.
There's two signals that are starting to, we don't have time to go into the nuance of how come it takes so long for them to figure out what's going on.
Yeah.
Okay. But, one of them is, thrombocytopenia, that's not having the platelets.
Okay.
So right now we're focusing on bone marrow signals. Okay. Thrombocytopenia is one of them. Another one that is very hard to understand that's starting to come up in the database is reactivation of latent viruses. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is shingles. Shingles is an example of that, but there are many others, and there's something in the literature about reactivation of latent human retroviruses. Okay, so it is there are anomalous findings cropping up, and I concur that it was when I received these data to evaluate. I gave you that whole story. Okay. Those are two of the things. And by the way, what's really odd to me about the ovarian signal is there's no signal in the testis.
Right. It's very low.
And a colleague of mine, Dr. Kevin Tamara, has done a lot of thinking and reading about that because it bothers him too. He's a urologist. So he kind of specializes in the male reproductive system. And he has some theories having to do with charge associated, because these are charged lipids. So there are particular features of the ovary that may, and as opposed to the testis, that may explain some of this, but it doesn't get us away from the two core things. Number one, this was known with the original data packages. The Japanese data package is essentially a historic document. It's different from what the FDA is currently looking at. So these data have been out there a long time. And yes, we have a whole lot of messaging. But
not in public view.
Within the purview, the confidential,
of the regulators.
Protected, not disclosed this is purview. Yeah,
this is company confidential.
Of the regulators across the world.
But not okay.
This messaging that
company we're all confidential.
Good, so let's nothing not get to worry lost. About. Yeah. That messaging was inconsistent with these signals that were apparent, at least inside of
the data. That the regulators knew
the data
about.
Or the data.
Yeah. Okay. So
they know.
We've got potential long-term, we've got short-term implications in the bone marrow. We've got potential long-term implications in the bone marrow. We have short-term implications in the ovaries. We've got potential long-term implications. I would add to the list what I've been worried about most from the beginning are autoimmune disorders that might show up in the long term. Is that plausible as you see it?
We talked about this earlier. And for me, It's less the lipid component, although that certainly has merit for autoimmune. It's more the circulating free spike protein, which we didn't expect in the literature. And we were the developers assured us this would not happen. The literature suggested we would not have free spike.
Yep.
And then Harvard and Brigham did a study in nurses, and lo and behold, we clearly have free spike after vaccination.
Yep.
And that has a whole other set of implications, but autoimmune development of autoimmune disease against complexes of foreign protein plus normal human proteins is certainly something that you'd have to monitor for.
Yep.
As we were discussing, the way that that's part of the reason why you typically want a 2 to 3 year follow-up period on the initial group of phase three patients to make sure that autoimmune consequences don't develop, because they typically take time.
Right. And this is why, you know, they always say that there's no such thing as a vaccine that is developed fast. You know, the fastest we've ever developed a vaccine has been like 7 years or.
Yeah, probably unless we go back mid-century when things were loose and fast.
Right. But there's a reason for that. It's not just that. Okay, well, we didn't have the technology. We have better technology now. We still need to be able to see what the long-term effects is on a 12-year-old.
You can't fast-forward time. And in fact, usually you use animal models to do that, and the assumptions on which the animal models bring these things to light are faulty.
Right, and how do you judge the effect on a 12-year-old?
What the animal models give us is a signal that alerts us to things that we need to follow up on carefully in humans.
Yes, okay, so hold on. So just to make this segment clear, okay, we've got very alarming short-term stuff. We've got short-term stuff that is alarming on the basis of where we find these lipids, where we find the spike proteins. Those things are reasons for concern because it wasn't supposed to be this way. We've also got an alarming signal in terms of the hazards and deaths, or the harms and the deaths that are reported in the system. And there's a reason to think that those are dramatic underreports.
Yes, and they're all consistent with the spike distribution.
That's two parts of the harm equation. Okay, the harm equation involves there appears to be short-term harm being done at an alarming level. Long-term harm is quite plausible based on what we already know about what's taking place, but we, of course, are going to take time to figure out whether it's actually
find out, and then it's going to be too late. You can vaccinate yourself, but you can never unvaccinate.
Okay, so then there are two other harms that are potentially involved in this vaccine. I wanted to get your input on whether it's worth worrying about these things. One of them, as made famous by Gerrit Vandenbosch, who was a guest on this program, is the hazard of the vaccines, because they create a very concentrated evolutionary push on spike protein alone, that vaccinating into a pandemic rather than in advance of a pandemic is liable to cause the evolution of escape mutants, and that it could in fact make a much worse pandemic in the end.
So this isn't a theoretical, this is a real.
It's real.
We already have the data.
What does that mean?
We are having escape mutants arise all over the place.
Yep. And you believe it is caused by the vaccines,
So because we got two variables going on at the same time, we've got vaccination and we got natural infection.
Yep.
But in my mind, I mean, the data are in.
Yep.
The escape mutants are happening.
Yep.
We have focused on the spike domains that are associated with escape from the vaccine domains. We have neglected to focus as a community on the other mutations that are also accumulating.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a sampling or selection bias.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's review what they've said. Mind you, this is the scientist behind the development of the RNA technologies that all these manufacturers have used. But just about 4 months ago, there was a reporter condemning anyone, Del Bigtree, who even entertained having a scientist on, who was warning us that what if there was a component of this vaccine that was able to stimulate the immune system in such a way that it was easy for this to escape, shed, in effect. And this person was condemned and ridiculed. You heard what they just said. Now that we know that there is shedding, he was right. We're bringing him on the program for an hour, hopefully in the next week. In fact, tomorrow I'm bringing on one of America's leading pediatricians for a discussion about children getting this COVID vaccine when they have zero chance of dying from COVID. So that makes no sense. If there's no opportunity for someone to die, why would you give them something that could cause their death or adversely affect their immune system at far greater levels than what the virion would do? Now, we also learned that now the spike protein is not staying encapsulated in the arm, but rather it's going throughout the body. It's causing a spike in problems with the ovaries. And that means that pregnant women have got serious issues. Now we're finding out miscarriages at very high levels in women who would, should not have had a miscarriage. And now they're also finding it in bones, leading it could lead to lymphomas and cancers. All these things you're just finding out. Would you have taken the vaccine had you known this was possible? Also, people who were vaccinated, but also previous to being vaccinated, came down with a virus. That meant that once you survived the virus, you were immune, period, just like chickenpox or measles. But they wanted you vaccinated in any case. So just about everything they could do, they've done wrong. And we've called them out on it. So just to remind you that. And finally, we're going to go to a second clip. This is not very long. And as I mentioned, this is Dale Bigtree, who's doing a lot of good work out there by offering a forum for people to share their points of view on this topic. He is interviewing former Pfizer Vice President and virologist Michael Yeadon. Here's what they have to say.
Just in terms of background, I've always been someone who likes tinkering with concepts, science, machinery. I always like to try and understand how things work, when they're broken, why they've gone wrong, and what can I do to fix it. That's kind of a whole approach to thinking about science and everything, really. And so early on in 2020, we were told there was this new virus emerging from, you know, from China. And I was kind of, I believe what the media was telling me, because, you know, I'm a normal kind of middle class guy. I expect my national broadcasters to largely tell the truth. And so when they got to the point of telling us that we needed to lock down, this was, I guess, in March 2020 in the UK, I remember feeling this is just really strange. I mean, OK, how bad is this that we've got to lock down, and will it work anyway? So I started in the first 3 weeks. We were told 3 weeks to flatten the curve. I don't know if anyone has a hollow laugh at 3 weeks to flatten the curve, but we do. But anyway, after the 3 weeks, two things happened. One is the peak of daily deaths had clearly passed in the UK. We could see it falling, and I expected to do that. We could talk about why I was confident. And so I was shocked when the government, after 3 weeks, said, we're going to extend this lockdown. And that my wife tells me I was raving, running around the house thinking, there's something seriously wrong. The Swedes have got it right. What the hell is going on? Because at that point, I'd done enough thinking to be absolutely certain that lockdowns couldn't possibly work. And I it may be a big claim, but I can explain. It's very easy.
Please, right and there. Then extended, please do. Please, let's yeah. Right there. Why wouldn't lockdowns work? That.
Yeah. So let me just take a step back. I think it's few things I want to just communicate in case I forget them in the heat of the moment. I want people not to be frightened of this virus. And as I go through what I'm going to say, I hope, far from it being a shocking statement, surely we should be frightened. It's terrifying. Don't be frightened of the virus. I'm afraid everything our governments and their scientific advisors have told us for a year and a half are all lies. All lies. They're not just a little bit wrong. It's not a matter of opinion. I'm going to just take you through the evidence that says the people who are advising my government, I respect as professionals. That means they know everything I know. So when I conclude it's definitely not true, you know, item X, and we'll go through these items, that means I know they know that too. And that means they're telling untruths deliberately, and we call that lying. So it's not a frightening virus. We're lied to about absolutely everything. I think the objective is to make us receptive to the vaccines, and we should talk about those. And then lastly, where the hell is this all going? Now, you know, I'll lead you through my evidence and where that's pointing. Because as I say to my wife when she says what's happening next, I always joke and say it's not my crime. Because I think there's a serious crimes going on. But let me just take your initial viewpoint. So yeah, let me just start where I was though. I don't want people to be frightened of this virus. The reason I'll point to some data that one of the most esteemed epidemiologists, Dr. John Ioannidis, working at Stanford in America, has been tracking this, you know, this infection around the world for over a year. And he's recognized by the WHO. He'll often have his reports on the WHO website. When you look at the global infection fatality ratio, it's a measure of how dangerous is this virus. It turns out it's a little bit more than seasonal influenza. A typical seasonal influenza kills 1 in 1,000 people, nearly always people at the end of their lives who are vulnerable and old and ill. And SARS-CoV-2, it's about 0.14, 0.15. So it is a little bit worse, but it's in the same ballpark. I would say it's not worse than bad seasonal influenzas, but worse than the average. So, and yet that's not the impression you're given. The governments give us the impression, and all of their policy responses give you the impression, that this is something like, as nothing has been as bad as this since, say, the First World War, the 1918 flu. And it's simply not true. So, and then we'll come back to this. There are some really good treatments for this infection. That's one of the things I, as a drug discoverer, it makes me very angry that good treatments that are well evidenced have been hidden from us, and sick people have been deprived of excellent safe therapy in order to continue people's fear, unfortunately. That's the situation. So it's not that dangerous a virus unless you are very close to the end of life, very frail, and usually also ill. But let me just move through then the things that I assert are lies. So, but that's first. We are given to understand this is a terrifying virus. And I've just told you that the best epidemiologist in the world has assessed the situation and said it's a little worse than typical flu. It's right. In the range of flu. That's a big deal. The next thing they told us is, well, they implied or told us that there are no treatments. And that's simply not true. That we know that over the last year and a bit, lots of physicians, and I've got to know one, Dr. Peter McCulloch in the States, really passionate physician. And he just refused to accept what he calls treatment nihilism. If you get sick, you just phone the hospital and they just say, stay at home. And only if you get so sick that you can't cope, then come to the hospital, and then we'll start to treat you. And he, like other doctors, said, well, we know how to do some things for viral replication, for inflammation. Why aren't we trying stuff? And so he and others, and I would call out Pierre Corey, Zev Zelenko, trying to remember, Didier Raoult in France. So they have tested and proven that things like hydroxychloroquine used early in infection can reduce viral replication. That later, or at any stage actually in the disease, you could use ivermectin, and it clearly reduces inflammation in the lungs. If you do get inflammation, then this is right back in my area of allergy and respiratory, good old inhaled steroids used for asthma and COPD. Inhaled budesonide is excellent at reducing inflammation. And then the end stage disease, if you're really unlucky, you can get blood clots, and we'll come back, Del, to why that is with this particular virus. And there are some good anti-inflammatories. So there are four really good drugs. And had these been made available, then honestly, I think we'd have been through this in a couple of months. So you've got to ask yourself, and all the time I was dialing up, why is what's happening? This makes no sense. So I did notice that, as you mentioned, early in the summer, I started looking at what they were doing for diagnostics, and they were using this PCR test. I'm sure you've talked about it on your program. It's a very powerful technique, but it's not a good technique for diagnosing viral infections, as the inventor, Carrie Morris, who won a Nobel Prize for its invention, will tell us repeatedly, it's good at detecting things, you know, a piece of DNA or RNA. But I noticed that I could see that they were being sneaky. You know, the people working in the UK, they refused to disclose how many cycles they were using. They refused to use an internal standard, and they claimed they didn't have samples of the virus. So I just thought, how can you not have an internal standard? Just for people who don't know, if you're using a diagnostic test, then you should always want to plot, you should use some of the thing you're trying to detect and put it into the test and show that it can detect it. And then you can use it, that method to work out where to position the standard curve, as it were, when you try and test a clinical sample. And all I could see is they were not using these standards, and they were using as much amplification as the machines would use, rather than the amount that you should use to work out if infection was present. And by the summer, I was absolutely certain they were, basically, they were turning up the amps to 11, you know, over amplifying it, not using internal standards. What else was there?
So let me just jump in here really quick for my audience that maybe knew some are a little bit more educated. What we're talking about, running these cycles here in America, New York Times, we did an investigation of PCR tests. We found here in America that every lab apparently was running about 45 cycles on these PCR tests. My understanding is even Tony Fauci himself said, I think it's beyond 22 cycles. Odds are that there's no infectious material, or maybe 26 cycles somewhere in there. But really, you start this major decline from a reality of an infection right around 10 cycles is where, you know, you start really seeing this steep decline in the quality of the information that you're getting. So just to, and maybe you can clarify, maybe I'm sure you're the specialist, but for people listening, you imagine, I always just say it's like a microscope. You just keep turning it and going deeper and deeper in. Eventually, you can be looking at something so, you know, a dead fragment cell that you ran into. It doesn't mean your body is infected with it. But at 45 cycles, the amplification is so gigantic, anything looks like a problem.
Yes, it's exactly right. So certainly by about this time last year, some very assiduous workers had tested, I think, hundreds of people who had SARS-CoV-2, and they've worked out the relationship between symptoms, the number of cycles of this test before you could detect whether they had the virus present or not. And here's a really important thing, whether they could culture the virus, grow the virus on, shall we say, in cells. And they found that when you got a positive test beyond about 25 cycles, it became more and more difficult to be able to infect some cells in a culture dish. In other words, there wasn't enough live virus there to deliberately infect a culture dish when you're trying to infect. So I drew the line and thought, well, okay, if you're over about 25 cycles, if it takes more cycles than that to show some presence of little snippets of this virus, then there's not enough virus there to make you infectious at all. And and that number seems to be in the mid-20s. No one's really sure, but mid-20s perhaps. But as you say, in the UK, I think they were using 39 cycles. And as you say, I've heard over 40. Each cycle doubles the amount of material roughly in this, you know, in this test. Mm. And so they were multiplying up, believe it or not, I did the maths, it was about a trillion fold. And so, as the inventor said, the lower limit of detection is one molecule. Now,
okay, that's just part of a longer interview. All of our interviews are posted on GaryNall.com. We're going to come back in a moment with a woke commentary, but I just want to mention two things. First, we've had such enormous success with our four anti-aging studies, totaling 8 months, that I had to be on campus, but was happy to do so because we set history on its ear when it came to thinking what was normal aging. And I was thinking about this morning. A group of just amateur filmmakers took their cameras to dance parties, probably about 50 dance parties, and then they filmed things. Some were okay. Some were, they didn't have any lighting, so you couldn't see anything. Others were done very well. I don't know who they are, but they sent them or they posted them. So there's a bunch of them up on Facebook, YouTube. And I suggest if you were one of the like 85,000 listeners who joined in those over the years, go back and look at yourself. Why? Because I remember just last night, I've moved out of New York City and everything was brought down here, and I was going through old photographs, and here were all these photographs of people attending the Fertiller Farm, my first sleepaways, where people would come and we'd have a wonderful time, learn a lot, share a lot. And that was 1971. And I'm thinking, okay, that's 50 years ago. Now, let's just say someone was 30. That means they're 80 today. What happened in between? What do they look like? Are they still alive? Let's say that they were in their 20s, then they're in their mid-70s now. And I remember that our first summer, it was all young people, people in their 20s. We'd play volleyball. We had a great time. And each year for the next 14 years, all summer and into the fall, every weekend, about 50 people would come up. And then on Sundays, families could come up and we'd have big picnics. And it was just absolutely phenomenal. One of the best times of my life. And I got to meet how many wonderful human beings. And then we had the cover dish dinners. So big in one case out Long Island. I don't know who in this audience right now was there. But the restaurant couldn't handle it, so they got permission to take the entire parking lot of a shopping center. We had 1,300 people came. People Magazine came out that day and did photographs, and those are up on my website. And I'm wondering, what happened to all these wonderful people? And then the dances. I remember some of the names. There was Virginia Reed and Eater, Anna Goldwasser, and a lot more. We would dance, had a great time, and you see them then in their prime. Where are they today? What's happened in their life? I'm interested in the human stories. So if you'd like to send in your human story and photographs of what's happened in your life over the last 10 years, 20 years, let's start with 10 years and go back. And then I'll share these with our audience. Just send them to prnstudio@gmail.com. prnstudio@gmail.com. So we can catch up. And then after I looked at all these photographs, then I was watching some of the dance, and we had some really good dancers in this audience. And you see yourself, because thousands upon tens of thousands of people were filmed. And that was a moment in time. And when we think back about the fond memories, but a lot of people believe that, well, there's inevitability. Yes, death is inevitable, but how we die and when is our choice, that if we use it. And that's why all these studies are so important. That's why the information I'm sharing on how to make healthier choices, so you're not aging in the same way, and you're actually reversing aging. We can reverse thinning and graying of hair. We can reverse wrinkles. We can reverse loss of muscle mass. So many things we can reverse if we pay attention and if we do it. So in September, the last 2 weeks, this upcoming September, we're going to do a retreat down in Texas, and a whole lot of new stuff going on down there. A lot of fun homesteading projects, as there was this last time, where people would say, look at these magnificent salads. Well, you don't get any fresher than going out that morning and clipping 40 different vegetables out of a hydroponic house or growing 100 different trays of sprouts. And now we're doing homemade Essene breads, flourless breads, and doing a lot of stuff. So we're going to do mindful meditation, have a whole new staff coming of lecturers, doing all types of wonderful things to de-stress, detoxify, rejuvenate. I'm putting all these components into the idea of let's exhale, let's be free from the past so we still have a viable future. That no matter what you see now, what you're seeing now is the total accumulation of all those years of thinking that it wasn't important. I can get to it. I'll read that book. I'll do that project. I'll get that hobby. I'll go visit that place. And then you realize you haven't and you may not. So I don't want you feeling that you can no longer be vital. You can. You can no longer be dynamic. You can. But you have to want to. You have to make it a priority. And for those of you who want to make that a priority, then you'll give Luann a call and say, yeah, I want to be part of overcoming depression and anxiety, being revitalized and rejuvenated, having the best in anti-aging input. Luann's number is 903-881-7008, 903-881-7008. And Jesse, if we have any of the testimonies of the people who were just there, let me know and we'll let people hear some of the experiences of people who are there just for a week. Okay, let's go to a couple right now.
My name is Evelyn, and I'm 72 years old. In two more weeks, I'll be 73. Let me tell you a little bit of my experience at the villa. I walked today. I completed 5 miles today, and it took me little to no time to get up the mountain and come back down and do a completed 5 miles. I lost one dress size. My hair has grown, and I feel much, much stronger. I'm able to pull down 50 pounds at my age, and I feel like I've accomplished a lot since I've been here.
Hi, this is Winona. I am 74 years old, and since I've been here, I've lost 15 pounds. I've lost a lot of fat. I've gained muscle and bone. My blood pressure went down. And I, before I came, I thought I was drinking plenty of water and I was completely hydrated, but I found out that I am totally dehydrated, and that has improved, and I feel a lot better as a result. In the beginning, I was lifted 65 pounds, and now I'm lifting 115 pounds, and I can pull a 150-pound tire. Today, I just completed 10 miles of walking. Power walking, and when I came, I was doing 1 mile, and I thought I was done. So that's a great improvement. I understand better of what and how much I should be eating, and to stop eating at 7 p.m. rather than eating and, you know, come getting in and eating at 9, 10 p.m. The meditation has been wonderful, and the journaling, and I've gained a lot of insight. And now know more of what I need to do at home. And as my life was, since I retired recently, and I was beginning to feel that I needed to do more with my life to keep it from being dull. So I came to see Gary Noll.
Hello, this is Bruce. I am 65 years old. And I came to the study for several reasons. One, I was at an inflection point in my life. I was retiring, and I feel I had a direction, but I feel it wasn't focused enough. So that's one thing. The other thing is I was aging prematurely, what Gary would call aging prematurely, which you know would affect most people. You know, I've slowed down. I was huffing and puffing going up hills. I was getting I had a pot belly, and my blood lipids were really in bad, really bad shape. In fact, the nurse Luann said, you know, I was a cardiac patient waiting to happen, basically. You know, so I had some health issues that needed to be addressed. And so, in any case, I came here about 7.5 weeks ago. And I've really made some breakthroughs, I would say. My body fat when I came here was about 15%, and now it's down to about 5%, which is really unbelievable. I was just hoping to get down to 10% where I was when I was doing marathons about 30 years ago. My blood pressure has gone down significantly, which is great, which shows you know, lack of stress response. I made significant weight loss, about 22, 23 pounds, which I think is great. I feel more at peace with myself. And as Gary would say, you know, we have to discover our authentic self. And I think I made tremendous progress as far as that goes, because I've really done a lot of journaling here in addition to all the protocol, which includes a lot of holistic modalities. But really, it's the journaling and the self-reflection and being in nature that I think has turned it around for me. So I feel excellent about that. My endurance has improved dramatically. I mean, we have something called battling ropes here where you have to move these heavy ropes up and down for a period of time. When I got here, I was able to do it less than a minute. And then just a day or two ago, I was able to do it for like 63 minutes, which is really just quite a breakthrough, and I feel really good about that. My bone density has gone up, my water percentage has gone up, and my muscle has gone up. So as my fat has gone down, all three of those have gone up, which is actually good. It's very good. So in any case, I hope this study makes a significant societal impact, because I think we are aging the wrong way as far as society goes, and we need to think of a new paradigm as far as aging. So that's it for now. I'm going to go back on the road, hopefully do a half a marathon. All right, that's it for now. Bye-bye.
Hello.
And I found photographs just last night of Bruce from 35 years ago, where we were doing the marathon together. And on GaryNall.com, there's over 80 self-empowerment videos with another 150 coming that I found that no one's ever seen before. I've done over the years. I've just never had the time to get them out to the public. Now they are. And it was interesting. I saw Bruce in one of those. I've seen a lot of people. You see yourself in all these lectures and the dance parties. Watch those. But it's time. I was just thinking this morning. It's time that we turned around and went in the opposite direction. Gave up the dramas, gave up the crisis, gave up the bad relationships, gave up anything that was not honoring us, and start to put the energy on honoring us so we have a whole new chapter that begins. So, join me. Call Luann. 903-881-7008, 903-881-7008, and that will be the last 2 weeks, 1 or 2 weeks of September. And we're closing out today with a special, and it's a terrific special. I want to thank Diane and Sandy and Neil and Glenn for putting this together. It starts off with digestive stuff. Now, everybody can benefit from having improved digestion. And this invention, it's a tasty powder, helps you in that process. I take what is the best possible things, I believe, for your digestion. Bananas, apples, pineapples, papaya, bromelain, digestive enzymes like cellulase, amylase, protease, lipase. I also take in probiotics, 10 billion probiotics, and of course organic ginger root and organic cinnamon bark and organic aloe vera whole leaf and organic marshmallow root and anise seed and fennel seed and slippery elm bark and stevia. That's it. They're all together. So it's a wonderful product. And you take one scoop after your main meal of the day. That's it. But guess what you get with this? Probably America's greatest chef, David Boulay. David is a friend of mine, he and his wife. And I did a documentary on David. It's called The Art of Healthy Cooking with David Boulay. And it will change your perception of what healthy dining can be. You could be a gourmet chef in your own kitchen. And David shows you how to do it. That documentary, award-winning documentary, you're getting. You're also getting the big book, the National New York Times bestseller, Get Healthy Now. Now, I haven't had copies of it. I got some copies, and you get the copy of the book. It's a huge book, but you're also getting a serving of memory stuff with acetyl L-carnitine and ginkgo biloba and green tea and D-calcium pentothate and quercetin and calcium ascorbate, magnesium citrate and thiamine, B1 and rosemary, and Eleutherococcus, form of ginseng and flaxseed, lecithin, cacao. You're getting all this in this delicious tasting chocolate flavored drink. You're getting a serving called Memory Stuff. And you're also getting a serving of Cardio Stuff. Cardio Stuff with the important ingredients like oat bran and Jerusalem artichoke and inulin and flax meal and sunflower lecithin and blueberries and a lot of other ingredients. So you're getting all this stuff in one, all right? And you're not paying the regular price that you would be charged, which is, it would be somewhere, what is it? It's around, I think it's around $190 or more than that, $199. You're paying only $99.99. So you're getting a 50% discount. How do you get it? Simple. You simply call this number. This is a phenomenal package. It'll be shipped out today. Call 877-627-5065. That's 877-627-5065 for this phenomenal package. Great discount, 50% savings. Or you can call Neil in the Vitamin Closet in our headquarters at 646-926-5430. 646-926-5430. We're out of time. The commentary on the woke generation will be tomorrow, plus one of America's leading pediatricians who's pro-vaccine, pro-orthodoxy. She's all that, but she is also very critical of giving children the COVID vaccines. Dr. Elizabeth Mumper, M-U-M-P-E-R, will be live tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.